Hello, everyone. I'm Eugene Porter de Leon at Porter de Leon on Twitter, and this is episode 130 of the In Tech We Trust podcast. On this episode, we dig into the role that federal funding has played in fostering the many waves of innovation that we've seen in our lifetime.
What I think that people often lose sight of today is that Silicon Valley exists entirely because of government funding. The internet exists entirely because of government funding. Before the internet, before DARPANET, Lockheed Martin, a defense contractor, was the largest employer in the valley.
And we talk about some of the differences in how quickly technology is adopted in public agencies versus the private sector.
Right. And part of that is because it goes through such a tough kind of vetting and certification and accreditation process. So it's never going to be a new product comes out tomorrow and then we install it the next day. It's never going to happen with the government because of the security concerns. But there needs to be a way to speed that up so that way the public sector is not so far behind everybody else.
Also, as you all know, GDPR is coming. Rick and I talk about what this broad sweeping regulation means for companies when it goes into effect in 2018.
You know, a lot of people are hemming and hawing and bemoaning GDPR, but as we go into the future, I mean, I can't think of anything more important than to steward and manage and guard the data.
Who makes big ideas happen? We've all benefited from some amazing revolutions in technology, R&D, and infrastructure, but most of these are far too large and complex and costly to have been accomplished by any one company, or any one country in some cases. So how do big ideas, I mean really, really big ideas, get started when most of them make absolutely no sense when you look at your corporate balance sheet? Railroad infrastructure, electrical grids, phone lines, and finally, yes, the internet were all big ideas that came from somewhere. But where? Who got the ball rolling on light-speed communication or clean water for that matter? Well, as most of us know, the government at some point has to step in to make these technologies commercially viable or at least subsidize the efforts of private companies so that the benefits can be enjoyed by all of its citizens. So how are we doing with that? Well, in terms of percentage of GDP, federal investment in R&D has waned over the years, according to the Brookings Institute and their tracking of data from the Congressional Budget Office. Federal spending as a percentage of GDP has decreased by more than half, from a height of 1.92% in 1964 to just 0.86% in 2013. So what does this mean? Is the federal government reducing spending on R&D because there is so much money in the tech industry already that they no longer are needed? China is ramping up spending and investing heavily in startups in order to foster domestic innovation. But what does that mean for American companies that don't get the same support? Does it matter now that the US is spending less in R&D since there's so much VC funding that startups can take Series Z rounds? And that's the topic of our show today, government in tech. Or more specifically, what is the role that government should play moving forward? Well, here's what we found out.
In tech we trust. It's the people in charge we're not sure about.
But first, I had the chance to talk to Lisa Kaywood at Real Lisa on Twitter, Director of Ecosystem Development for Open Daylight and ONAP at the Linux Foundation, about what role does or should government play in the tech industry, as well as what role they play in our technology-enabled lives. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I wanted to get your take on this, Lisa, as this is a show themed about what government, you know, what role does government play? How can they enable, how they get in our way and where they should get out of our way? And I know you actually offered some unique perspectives on where you feel like government can fit in. Lisa, what's your take on this?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I grew up here in Silicon Valley. We moved here in 1975. I won't say exactly how old I was at that time, but I was pretty young. And so Silicon Valley really is my home. Over the ensuing decades, I've seen the culture here shift quite a bit and not necessarily in terribly productive ways. What I think that people often lose sight of today is that Silicon Valley exists entirely because of government funding. The internet exists entirely because of government funding. Before the internet, before DARPANET, Lockheed Martin, a defense contractor, was the largest employer in the valley. It employed tens of thousands of people here in the 50s and 60s and into the 70s. HP also contributed heavily as a defense contractor in its early days, and you know, so forth and so on. So these were all things that got off the ground to a large extent because of government funding, not just in terms of purchasing, but also investments in terms of basic R&D. And, you know, people sort of tend to lose sight of that, you know, because they tend to think of government as being heavy-handed and bureaucratic and you know, the equation of government involvement sort of conjures up, you know, visions of, you know, rows of faceless and uncooperative bureaucrats that, you know, whose sole mission in life is to tell you no.
Yeah. My experience is like going to RSA and like cruising by the NSA booth and they're trying to give me a pen and I'm like, I'm not taking your pen from the NSA. There's a microphone in there somewhere.
Well, you know, and you know, to be fair, I mean, that is actually one area where the government does continue to invest, especially in security companies, right? But the tech industry as a whole in the U.S. has gotten quite libertarian, which is really, I think, has to do with the overall youth of the industry and sort of lack of historical perspective. And it's kind of, there's sort of two things going on. There's the lack of historical perspective and then also sort of the triumph of Wall Street and the tyranny of the quarterly earnings report, so that, you know, even if large companies on their own wanted to do things like Xerox PARC and other types of, you know, sort of long-term basic research, that becomes increasingly hard to justify and hard to fund. That is not entirely driven by government regulation or lack thereof, but it is, you know, those two things coming together are really driving, I think, a lot of short-sightedness in the American tech scene in particular. If you contrast that with what's happening, for example, in China, and I was a student in China 20 years ago, and have been going back quite a bit recently. Obviously, in theory, a centrally planned economy. In practice, there's a great deal of interplay between the central government and the regional governments, as there is in the U.S. And, you know, they have gone through the process that Europe went through kind of in the 60s and 70s of, they're in the process of denationalizing a lot and privatizing a lot of the sort of the main upstream industries, you know, steel, power production, telecommunications, things like this, car manufacturing. The government still remains involved. Originally, you know, early on when I was first a student in China, they tended to have significant financial stakes in the companies that they were kind of spinning off and quote unquote privatizing. And if they did not officially have a financial stake, invariably you would need to have, you know, your pal, the general of such and such, involved in your company in some form or fashion. The companies I work with now have been very professionalized. Government is still definitely very involved, but the way they do it, for example, is, just to pick one example, in Nanjing, they are opening up a whole research park. They're investing hundreds of millions of dollars in this research park over the next 5 years. They have built a number of office buildings and a couple of hotels, and they are already holding conferences there. And they have multiple goals with this. One is to, of course, stimulate in investment and research in the telecommunications industry. The secondary goal is to bring investment into second-tier cities like Nanjing, which are, you know, sort of less overbuilt. There is a university presence in Nanjing, and so it's a way of bringing together professional jobs and secondary communities with the with academia, as the U.S. used to do as well. And again, that was another sort of, you know, seed kernel of Silicon Valley success, was the presence of highly trained people coming out of universities. Yeah. And continued partnership with universities, even, you know, sort of public-private, you know, public academic partnerships. And so the Chinese have taken those kernels of what really made Silicon Valley a success, and they're doubling down. In addition to kind of the sort of the infrastructure investment, they're doing, you know, the reason they're building these office buildings, and right now many of them are empty, but, you know, they will offer startups 5 years of free rent. in those buildings. You know, you can imagine as a startup, now all that means, rather than, you know, having to raise, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars just to cover your rent in San Francisco.
which is a huge challenge, you know, in the peninsula especially.
Right. And, you know, instead of having to do that, you can actually focus the money that you do get, whether it's from government sources or otherwise, and your revenues in the early years on, you know, productive things, on you know, engineer salaries and on marketing and things like this. And at the same time, you know, there is that reservoir of basic research that is coming out of the institute, the government institute body that is associated with the university, but also associated with the incubators that they're building around them.
Yeah, I think that's just a lot of phenomenal points you brought up there. I mean, historical perspective, I think, is definitely one of them. And I think there's a great book called The Age of Ambition, where it talks about how China missed out on the Industrial Revolution and how now they're really, like you said, I think, doubling down on the technology revolution. And I think a lot of the historical perspective on how the rise of Silicon Valley is lost on a lot of the people here who do see government as something that's just in their way and not someone that's basically enabled all the fundamental technologies that they've built all of their fantastical products on top of and make all of their wonderful money off of. And public versus private, plus those academic partnerships, I think, was I think a really strong theme that has run throughout, I think, the U.S.'s history, especially with, you know, defense contract spending. A lot of academics within universities have put a lot of the papers that have been on, you know, the Department of, you know, Defense's desk for review for new, you know, technology research and development. But one thing I think that was really interesting and really intriguing is how open source software has seen this powerful support within governments like China, where you won't have that same kind of support in the U.S., where you say, well, you know, you might invest more in, you know, in closed source, even though the open source community is exploding. But maybe digging a little bit about how China's really supporting this explosion in open source.
Yeah. So and it was, there was a very telling comment came from a very senior executive at one of the Chinese firms we visited last month, and he made the comment that clearly, and you know, we see this all the time. I mean, China is going after open source very, very aggressively for a number of reasons. One is they have a very strong national desire to be economically self-sufficient. That is to say, not dependent on Western technology. It goes back to sort of a longstanding sort of sense of humiliation that they lost out on the Industrial Revolution, and that they got the Industrial Revolution done to them, as opposed to being active participants. And so they, you know, it's been mandated they will not be dependent on Western firms for their technology. That is a consideration not only of sort of national pride, but also of national security, for the same reasons that, you know, we will not accept a lot of, you know, Chinese-made technology, you know, in the U.S., right?
Yeah, no, I think that's an interesting dichotomy there.
But so, you know, that's part of what's driving it. But the other part, and what the executive said very pointedly, is we're not protecting anything here. You know, we don't have any companies' vested interests that we have to protect. He said open source is big here in China. It's also bigger in Europe than it is in U.S., he commented. And again, it's for the same reason, right? I mean, the U.S. companies have been so predominant in the technology sector that European companies, you know, coming from sort of more of the closed source world, didn't have a chance to catch up. Now they can go much more aggressively after being involved in open source type projects, which are very global, very flat in nature, and very dependent. You know, it's much more clearly a matter of who has the cool ideas as opposed to who has the most money and clout. And so, again, the Europeans don't have anything really to protect, at least not to the same degree that the US does. And so we're very much in a mode, I think, of sort of protecting the oligarchy rather than innovation for the sake of innovation. And it's a classic trap that predominant leaders, whether they be nations or companies, tend to fall into. But I see that as being kind of where we are as a country.
Interesting. And maybe just to kind of to focus this and wrap this all up, where do you think that the U.S. could take examples from, let's say, governments like China or some in the EU, and refocus that mode of oligarchy protection, maybe in the U.S.'s example, and refocus efforts in a way that could really be far more beneficial in some of the other ways, by picking a page from the playbooks of other countries?
Yeah, I mean, funding basic research again. I mean, you know, when you have a newly elected national leader making appeals to your scientists to come over and work in their country because their own will no longer financially support them in their endeavors, that's a problem.
Yeah, that's right. All our scientists are going to go to France now.
Well, and already, I mean, you know, I have friends who are in the solar industry, and they spend far more of their time in China than they do in the U.S. They spend far more time of their time in Germany than they do in the U.S. Because, again, those are countries who have chosen to get ahead of the curve rather than protecting old industries. And, I mean, Germany does not have a lot of sunshine, and yet they've invested tremendously in solar development, especially for their GDP and size.
When you hear stuff like that.
It's depressing. Frankly, as an American, you can either sit on your laurels or you can buckle down and get ahead of the curve and invest accordingly. And again, it's a matter of national security. This is something the Chinese understand very well. Another example, and this was at a government conference that I was at in Nanjing last month. You know, they kept talking about their academic partnerships and the research that they were sharing with similar institutions in Southeast Asia. That is part of, they have an initiative called, I think it's One Belt, One Road, and it is an initiative to rebuild infrastructure that has lain dormant since the 900s, when the land and sea routes between West Asia, Africa, and effectively through that Europe and China were sort of at their peak. They explicitly refer to the Silk Road as part of that initiative, and so they've been working with, you know, trying to get investment for roads, for telecommunication infrastructure, for railroads, for modernizing airports, especially in kind of less developed countries, and it is a soft power initiative. Absolutely and unquestionably, and they don't try to hide it. You know, a lot of the developing countries are sort of wary of that, but at the same time, you know, they're not going to turn down opportunities of you know, people investing in their countries. But you know, it's betting money to make money, building their presence in those countries, building markets who can eventually buy Chinese goods, and having people already on the ground, helping building a market that will be susceptible to Chinese goods and Chinese companies. And so they're absolutely playing the long game.
Lisa, this has been some fantastic perspective. I think there's a lot we could even dig into even more, but I think we're going to leave it right there. And I wanted to thank you for jumping on the show. Lisa, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Next, I had a chance to talk with Rebecca Fitzhugh at Rebecca Fitzhugh on Twitter, technical marketing engineer at Rubrik, to talk about the ways in which public sector and private sector organizations can leverage technology to improve real people's lives by modernizing government agencies the way they do things, to invest in technology that makes the world a better place. Rebecca, thanks for joining the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So one idea that I thought was fascinating is the idea of when government agencies really put resources behind a certain agency, certain organizations, there has been a transformative effect. Sometimes there's been good effects, sometimes not so good effects, or sometimes we can't even tell. What's been your perspective on some of the positive impacts that those kind of efforts can make when the government really puts some serious resources behind a particular organization that's able to affect real change?
Yeah, I always think of NASA as that example. Because our government modernized, because we pursued space travel and we had this goal of putting a man on the moon, so many innovations came out of that we still are using today, right? Like we've got digital imaging technology that's used with CAT scans and MRIs that came from NASA. You've got cool suit technology that was designed to keep astronauts cool during launch, but that's used still today by hazardous material workers, firefighters, NASCAR drivers, patients that have multiple sclerosis, and children that are born without sweat glands use these built-in water circulation vests that keep them cool. And again, that came from that same technology. You've got like Black & Decker created cordless lightweight devices, you know, like our wireless screwdrivers, things like that, that came from NASA's cordless innovations out of their patent. And even just renewable energy resources, solar panels, right? That idea came from the Apollo lunar module program.
That's really incredible, because I think when a lot of people think about this kind of innovation, they think about like DARPA and creating like the fax machine and the telephone and the internet and those kinds of things. Maybe actually the telephone's not a good example. I don't think that came out of DARPA. But they think about things like the internet. But what people don't, I think, really realize is that some of the cooling technology that you're talking about and being used for medical uses, and a lot of those externalities, those positive externalities that come from that kind of investment, I don't think those are really celebrated as much as a lot of the larger, higher impact technology innovations that most people kind of use in their daily lives.
I agree. And like for me, my daily life, one of the great examples I can think of was it's just something very, very simple. I'm a veteran, so I've used the GI Bill to take college courses, and only in the last year has the form been online. This is something that's
amazing. I mean, first of all, thank you for your service. I always like to get that out of the way. Thank you very much for your service.
Of course.
I think some of that's starting to get some visibility, but just having basic information or input-output systems via the web is transformative to what used to be an incredibly convoluted paper-based system, as I understand.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then, you know, on the bottom of the form, it tells you fax it. You're like, really? It's 2016. I don't know where there's a fax machine. So I'm glad that I can now submit it as an online form.
That's incredible. And I had to realize when somebody asked me to fax something, there's like, I had to go online and find like this virtual fax service. I'm like, cause there's just no physical fax machine in my reality.
No, you can go to now to like, I think like those like FedEx type print stores, and they can fax it for you for a nominal fee.
That's just profound. And it's one of the great things I've found, though, actually, is when you get one of those online faxing, digital faxing services, you can really send a lot more information to your senator when you really want to get a hold of them. That's just a pro tip. You can send automated faxes to them on a regular basis. I think you get two or three a day or something like that just to hit your senator to tell them what you want them to do.
Well, I think like you saying like hitting up your senator, I think like that's a great example of like being able to now petition online, right? And what was, I think the entry before for like a petition to reach the White House was something like 10,000 or 5,000 signatures. But because they modernized that and they put it as an online form where you could go and submit any type of petition, they actually had to raise the amount of signatures to like 100,000 because the community interaction was so great that there's too many petitions.
I guess they do have to set the bar a little higher, but that's an incredibly empowering transformation when you have something like citizenry able to access their government in a way that just was never possible before. People in all sorts of walks of life in different areas just would never have had that kind of a voice without that sort of equalizing force of something like the internet.
Absolutely. And you know, like we keep giving federal examples, but it doesn't have to just be at a federal government level, right? This can be done at a state or city level. Like I've quite a few friends that live in Houston, and Houston launched something a few years ago that I think they call something like Bayou City or something like that, kind of a play on words where it's not spelling the actual like body of water. And it's just this online forum that just talks about like arts and culture, neighborhood growth, community development, but it's monitored and moderated by local leaders, right? So it allows the citizens of Houston to interact directly with their leaders, and that's affecting real change at a lower level.
Yeah, and ultimately, that's where everyone really wants that change to really be effective. They want to feel it right here where they live in their daily lives, and ultimately, that's the goal. And a lot of people get a lot of visibility from things at the federal level, but at the state and local level is where I think most of the dramatic change happens. And this is, you know, I think on one of the points that I wanted to bring up as well, which is how a lot of states they're kind of siloed in certain ways, and it's empowering to operate in the state and local level, but there's also a lot of benefits from a lot of these state and local government agents being able to kind of talk together in a collective pool. And so to your example about sort of art and culture, and moderated by people in local communities, it would be really powerful for, you know, all of those different types of communities to be connected, to have all those different types of government, you know, programs connected. Because right now, let's say, for example, at the federal level, another sort of federal example is you've got about 8 different, you know, federal support programs. You know, only 10 have actually been rigorously studied, and maybe only one has actually been found to meet its defined purpose. And from that perspective, you don't have that kind of level of visibility for measurement of success for, say, a lot of these programs at the federal level, but let's say at the local level, from your example, you've got real interaction, real visibility, and you've got a way to affect change locally. And from your perspective, do you think that's a much more successful model, and maybe we can kind of adopt that more connected, community-based approach to something on the national or even on the state level?
I do. I think if we were able to really innovate and to really connect at a local level, and that bringing that community together and being able to improve that community in various ways, I think that in a way, I'm going to patent a term here, could have like a trickle up effect, right? Where you start seeing that at a higher level, where the state starts paying attention to the city because the city's doing all these great things, and then eventually the state makes it, you know, a policy statewide or, you know, whatever, and then we can start seeing that move up towards the federal government.
No, and I think there's a lot of power in that, and we've seen that in mayors who have decided to take action where the federal government did not. The federal government's decided to pull out of the Paris Climate Change Agreement, and the mayors at each local individual collective layer have decided to take up the mantle and just, you know what, we're just going to make effect local change here. We're not going to wait for the federal government to act. We're actually going to, as mayors of each city, going to participate in our own way into addressing climate change.
Yep, exactly.
Let me just get your perspective on one thing, and that is public versus private sector innovation. And everyone's really familiar with the private sector innovation and what the private sector has done independently of the government. But where do you think some of those collaborative benefits can come from public sector agencies in the federal, state, or local governments really working with private sector technology companies or even companies that aren't technology, but employing technology to kind of connect that public sector effort with the private sector effort to make that kind of positive change in people's lives?
I definitely think there needs to be more of a connection. You know, coming from a government background, coming from the military, like I remember getting out of the military in 2011 and looking at my resume and going to these tech companies and just almost laughing my own self out of the room because my skill set was so far behind everybody else's. It was awesome because I was pretty full stack and I had touched everything, you know, but I was working on, you know, Exchange 2003 in 2011.
Personally, do you think you were kind of done a disservice because the lack of modernization within government agencies? So you weren't actually given access to the latest infrastructure and applications to sort of build that resume.
Right. And part of that is because it goes through such a tough kind of vetting and certification and accreditation process. So it's never going to be a new product comes out tomorrow and then we install it the next day. It's never going to happen with the government because of the security concerns, but there needs to be a way to speed that up. So that way the public sector is not so far behind everybody else.
So anyway, you're telling me that the government's just not going to run trunk of OpenStack or Cloud Foundry?
not as quickly as other companies.
No, but I mean, yeah, because you have to set up, you know, sign up for FedRAMP to sign up for the NIST requirements when you're working with government agencies. And I think that's really positive, a really good benefit. But I think your perspective is incredibly unique because I don't think a lot of people think about how when you go into the military, I think there's some great opportunity there for building a resume, but I think it's also something that I didn't really consider of how far behind government organizations are from a technology perspective, so that when you take that into the private sector, you know, how tough it is to sort of make that leap.
Yeah, you know, and it varies from organization to organization, and even within the military, from branch to branch. You know, some, me being in the Marine Corps, if we focus on things that are more combat related, right, and expeditionary, rather than the underlying technologies that enable that. Whereas if you get into other branches like the Air Force, or even the Navy, they're a little bit more technologically advanced than we were. So it definitely varies across the board.
Interesting. And just maybe on one final thought too, where do you think the biggest opportunity is in not just modernizing the public sector organizations, but how the private sector really needs to get involved and really needs to contribute to that effort?
Well, I think there's so many amazing nonprofits out there, right? For example, like if you look at water, right? We all need water, and there's great technologies for water cleaning and water filtration that could be used to create infinite sources of clean water for everybody. How can we take something that's like nonprofit related or even being a private company and pull that into the public sector and pull that into the government and let them use that technology across the world? I don't know.
Oh yeah, no, I like that. I like that from a technology sharing perspective, and also I think maybe even from an information sharing perspective, where you said, you know, you connect data sources from anywhere from, you know, the Veterans Association to state and local, you know, information for unemployment, to all these different sort of data silos, in addition to sharing technology, just sharing information between organizations, I think would be transformative.
I do too, but I think that's all going to begin with trust.
Ah, and that's one of the key things that I think that that's tough. What do you think the hardest barrier is for agencies just to share information, just maybe as a final thought?
I mean, I think a lot of it is very much gets categorized in the need to know type buckets. If you don't need to know, you don't need to know, and we're not going to tell you. And so I think there's just a lot of security concerns, and many of which are valid, and then some of which are just for their own benefit, right? Where one government organization doesn't want to share with another government organization because they want to innovate first, or they want to have the credit, or they want whatever kind of selfish motivation they have.
Yeah, I guess you just can't, you know, legislate human nature out of anything.
Exactly.
All right. Well, Rebecca, it's been a fascinating conversation. I appreciate you joining the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Up next, I get to sit down with Rick Vanover at Rick Vanover on the Twitters, my co-host in Tech We Trust, on the show here today. And being that it's a government in tech theme for the show, Rick, I think we're going to be talking about GDPR. But first, before we get into that, Rick, how are you? How have you been? Are you busy? Where are you?
Oh, yes. Good. Poland. I have been busy, Yadin, and for the listeners out there, it's been a rough stretch for the Rickatron. I just came off of our big VMon event, and so that's the big exhale, but I'm recommitting back to the podcast. But yeah, we're over in Poland with a lot of our Europe team this week, and you know, one thing that came up was GDPR, and you know, yeah, we'll talk about that here.
Yeah, there's a lot going on, and it's May 25th, 2018 is that due date. So everyone's starting to ramp up just after the 1 year pre-anniversary for the GDPR taking effect. And there's a lot that companies are having to digest, and especially for large organizations that have a lot of moving parts and that have presence or have data from the EU and EU citizens' personal information. There's a lot that they've got to mull over. What's the big thing that people have been talking to you about, Rick?
Well, the big thing is it's more like identifiable information and persons' rights. I mean, I think it's one of those things about, above all, it's identity. But it also has some hooks into, like, topical things today. I mean, having good standards on data are a good idea today. You know, a lot of people are hemming and hawing and bemoaning GDPR. But as we go into the future, I mean, I can't think of anything more important than to steward and manage and guard the data. You know, the rules will change and be adapted and be painful at first. You know, this will
there's gonna be a lot of pain
gonna be a lot of pain, and it's not a lot of runway. You know, it was introduced on the 27th of April last year, and it'll be due in less than a year from now. So 2 years for a big rule to be, you know, something that people are gonna have to go through an audit. And you know, we got a 1 year warning shot, right? Like with WannaCry and SambaCry that came out, the SambaCry, the Linux equivalent, just about a year ahead of it. So I think we've got some good, like, momentum to kind of make this say, okay, look, this is a good idea.
There's a lot of trepidation out there, and a lot of people did feel like there's, once they picked it up, once it landed on someone's desk, especially in a large organization, there's a kind of a scramble right now. And Gartner's come out with some numbers. Gartner always has numbers that about 40 to 50% of organizations are not going to be compliant by May 25th, 2018, which I think is pretty telling. So about half of everyone is pretty much, they're going to not be done with this. And mm-hmm. like you said, the WannaCry ransomware attack really brought it to light as to how vulnerable everyone is. These are real threats. And if they have the data of EU citizens, whether it's housed there, whether it's housed in the EU and they're processing it, they're liable, and they can be fined. And these are not small fines. And the previous regulation didn't really have teeth. It wasn't. This is the first regulation that's really going to have real teeth, real fines, real money behind this. And some organizations are going to get caught flat-footed.
Yeah, and you know, one piece of advice I have for what I'm dealing with in my role, and I'm sure you kind of relate to this as well, is everybody's like, "Well, is this product or is this technology compliant?" And I'm like, "Well, first of all, out of the box, no, probably nothing is." And I really like to tell people this is a really good piece of practical information when it comes to this stuff, that it really depends on how a product or a technology is implemented, and then separately, how it's audited. That's going to dictate if you're compliant. So, you know, if you take anything that comes down the pike with that attitude, I think you're going to have a much better experience going through that, because it's going to be a learning experience. I can't give specific advice on what to do just yet, but that's going to be an attitude that'll guide everybody through this process pretty good.
Yeah, and maybe we should probably actually take a step back for those who aren't totally familiar with GDPR. And that's the General Data Protection Regulation from the EU that's going to be taking effect next year. And two of the big things that, just for the listeners, one is that it covers a huge breadth of what is considered, personal or personal identifiable or personal data for EU citizens. And you don't just have to be in the EU. You don't have to be, have data centers or people there. You could just be processing information, data transfer. And this gives people a ton of rights. They can say, "I don't want you to do X, Y, and Z with my information. I don't want you to process it anymore. I want to be able to have visibility." This is stuff that people just don't even have in their infrastructure. And I liken to it to imagine like you were part of, let's say, the Paris, climate agreement. And that's, a huge agreement, multinational. And these companies, or everyone in these countries are giving years to go ahead and implement this. This is like a climate change agreement, for, any company managing data, but you're only getting 1 year to change not only the technology, but as you mentioned, all the processes that go into handling the data and the way you do everything as a business. And 1 year, it is not a lot of runway.
Well, and there's, one, interesting angle that comes from the personal perspective, and that is that, there's this notion of the right to erasure. You have the right to be forgotten from your data, your identity, your personal identity bit. And it goes to this role called the data protection officer, right? So that, there can be jail. I mean, this is some legit stuff. So, the ecosystem's going to kick up. I'm sure a lot of professional services groups are going to work on implementation, audits, and sustainability in that regard to guide people through it. But, I can't even say that if you're not European, you don't need to care about it. And what I mean by that is it has broad transability, or data portability, I think is what they're calling it, where even if it goes through something else, or, if you receive data from, there's like some applicability there. So it's very broad, and I think we're all going to be learning a lot as we go.
To that last point, I think is specifically really important, because that broad definition is what is making this so impactful. And this is everything from not just like, we're not talking credit card numbers and driver's license numbers or any of that stuff, or we're talking like, political views. We're talking about any bit of information that could be identified as you, even outside of any other context of any other information. So this is massively broad. There's no legal precedent yet, because it hasn't gone into effect. It hasn't gone through the legal system. So it's basically anything that you touch, that you create, or is about you, or in context of you, could be considered protected by the GDPR, and you could be subject to fines, really heavy fines, and you said criminal consequences as well. So this is extremely serious. And one other point to tease out that you mentioned is, the right to be forgotten. And people think that, oh, well, you'll just go and delete the data. Oh, yeah, sure, because you know where every bit of data that even you personally, own is, in your own life. It's a massive problem. Like every little teeny tiny, tweet or bit of, a scrap of information that somebody might have that's been processed by, by Amazon or anyone else, that information is, to identify it, locate it, to find it in, archive backup tapes, it has to be removed from there. It's massive.
My hope is that it's kind of like a new airplane, you know, when they get launched, that they, you know, they just get delays on launch. So my hope is that everybody gets a little bit more time and then maybe we get some air to breathe. But, you know, that'll be something to definitely watch, follow, talk, and share on how to get through that for everybody.
Yeah, fantastic. So what would be the Ricketron's advice to, you know, big organizations right now? To sort of wrap this idea up, what would be the big takeaway? What do they need to start doing right now, today?
Well, just get your head around that mindset. It's nothing out of the box is or is not. It's how it's implemented, how it's audited. Work backwards from there, and then you'll be fine.
All right. Well, Rick, it was great chatting with you, and I'm sure we'll chat more about this as the GDPR unfolds.
Yeah. Ciao for now, Yadin.
And that's our show for this week. Research for this podcast was powered by Sprinklr, the social media management platform. To find out more about them, you can go to sprinklrwithnoe.com. If you haven't subscribed already, please do so on iTunes or the podcatcher of your choice and leave us a review if you will. It helps others find us. Also, we love hearing from you, the listeners, your story ideas, your thoughts on the tech world, and what you're doing as well, so that we can make this show as relevant to your daily tech life as possible. So hit us up on Twitter using hashtag InTechWeTrust. We'll be checking that daily to start conversations, engage with people, and get your thoughts. You can also follow us at InTech_WeTrust and give us your thoughts there as well. See you next time. Oh.